Kevin, thank you so much for being here with us again today. It's always such an honor to have you on.
Oh, it's always a joy to be back. Thank you, Emma.
You're so welcome. I'm excited for today's topic. And, we've had some really great podcast episodes. The thing I was telling you before we started recording that I really love about working with you is you're so knowledgeable about so much. So there's so much that we can talk about, whether it's as a big picture or sort of a focused detail. And so today I'm really excited for this conversation. I think it's really going to help people feel empowered to take their sovereignty into their own hands and to sort of have a direction on how to do that. So I thought maybe we could start. You're actually working with some groups right now, helping produce and manifest in real life this exact topic that we're talking about today, personal and sovereignty throughout a nation or throughout a community. And so I thought I would give you an opportunity to share a little bit about that because it's really revolutionary what you're doing.
Well, and what other more and more people are doing in two places, in America and England this last month, there's been a real coalescing of people who, some of whom we inspired, but other people have just come forward. It's kind of like this 100th monkey phenomenon of people are just coming from everywhere all of a sudden. And I mean, that was reflected in the fact that we sold over 1,200 of my books in the last 2 months. Normally, in the same period of time, we'd sell maybe 50 or 100. So it's going through the roof now, this interest. And yeah, you mentioned this book, and they both in America and England, these new groups are relying heavily on this. I'll tell you about them. First of all, in England, for a number of years, people have been trying to, they've shown kind of a passive interest in what we're doing in Canada because we're facing the same institution of the crown, right? And this last month, organizing committee has formed to establish a republic, sovereign republic in England, called the Republic of Albion, Albion. And that's a traditional Gaelic word. It kind of embraces a lot of the culture there. And it also reflects the fact that historically there was a republic in England. It's in under Cromwell and the Puritans, when they cut off the head of the King Charles in 1649, for 11 years they had a republic. Parliament abolished the monarchy in the House of Lords and said it was a crime of treason to reestablish the British monarchy. Well, Charles II comes along, does a military coup, overthrows the Republic, and reestablishes the monarchy. But it was never a de jure or lawful power. It was kind of a de facto coup. But it's never had, in other words, the British Crown has not had lawful authority since 1649. It's a power, but not a lawful one. And that really helped us when we set up the Republic in Canada, because we said, look, it's always been a fiction, literally, the authority of the crown. Well, the folks in England, they've now reached a critical mass, and they now have organizing committees in four different areas. In Ireland, because there is kind of a cultural and historical affinity in the north of Ireland, Scotland, Wales, and England. Okay, and they have a flag, which they're just, I'll send it to you later so you can post it. They're just in the process of kind of finalizing it, but they'll have the symbols of those four cultures on it. And they have agreed to very much follow the setting, kind of the outline we did in Canada, which is they've decided on a constitution. They're going to go public and say, look, this is not just replacing a figurehead, knocking out a king and putting in a president, right? This is a transformation from the grassroots. So they'll be setting up, as we did, local republic assemblies, courts, their own sheriffs to enforce it, making the appeal to people to switch allegiance, nullify their oath of allegiance to Charles and the crown, and take it to a constitution. So reviving the republic that's in their tradition. As a matter of fact, it was interesting because after the republic got overthrown, a lot of those folks came to America, to New England. It was interesting early on. People know the story of the Mayflower landing at Plymouth Rock in 1620. 50 years following that, there were people who used to be in the New Model Army who fought with Cromwell who had come over, refugees from England. And these folks wrote out the early statements in Connecticut and Plymouth of what their republic should look like. That is, they formed the first covenant, the first real identity, the new identity people had, that we are Americans because we are governing ourselves. We're not beholden to any ruler, any monarch, you know. And so there was that continuity. from England to America. And the same thing's happening now, because part two of this is in America, there is now we're in touch with people in 14 different states who are interested in this. And what they're doing is they want to issue a new Declaration of Independence against the existing system. And they've united Democrats and Republicans because they've lost the old labels. These are Americans who are saying, one of the people had at one of these meetings I took part in on a Zoom call, they had a big flag on the wall that said, neither Republican nor Democrat, but American, going back to the roots of who we all are and making that unity again. And people are so hungering for that, right? And this divisive conflict that's been going on, people now in America are saying we need a new declaration to remind us of what, to recover our soul, to remind us at the heart of America is the fact that not only are all people created equal, but they remain equal. And they've got to establish their own way to govern themselves in the law, in politics, in everything, so that all the citizens are involved. That, for example, there should be no laws passed in which we haven't had a say. The best laws come out of our own communities, where people get together and say, what do we want? How do we want our communities to be? And work that way from the grassroots. So it's really exciting. They want to issue this. They haven't set a date, but they're holding like what happened in 1770s. They're holding constitutional conventions all over, and they're making an appeal to people to come out from these labels of Republican, Democrat. Forget about the politicians, no matter who they are. This is not an attack on anyone. It's a reminder of America is a lot more than its politicians or its government. It's in the heart and soul of the people, and we're trying to recover that soul. So it was beautiful. I had tears in my eyes after talking to these folks, because it's like, finally it's happening where it should, because I still believe that America and what it embodies is the hope of the world, in the sense that, the common law republic was a fact here. It wasn't just a nice idea. It keeps rising up through slavery and through all of these wrong turns that the country took. There's this kind of gyroscope that keeps bringing us back on course all the time, right? And that's a sign that the whole world needs in this age of the corporatocracy. It's either a republic or this corporate monolith that's at the heart of all of these problems and crimes we've been talking about. So those are two really exciting developments. And of course, they want me to come over to England in the fall, and I'll be down in the States as well, helping with all this. But
Oh my gosh.
it's really
That
great.
is so neat. I love that people are finding your work and starting to learn about these things. I can't believe that this stuff isn't common knowledge to people living in society. People are just now finding out about this decades into their life and saying, oh, wait, I don't have to accept what's always been there. I can use my voice and get a group of people together and make a change. And I really love that you're being brought in on behalf of these different movements, especially that have to do with politics, because unfortunately, politics, I think, was rooted in maybe doing something good and creating law and order. However, throughout time, and especially now, the only purpose it really serves is to get people to hate one another, and it creates these little pockets of division and really compartmentalizes people from their own communities, and then they get so caught up in idolizing these people that don't know them, that don't give a crap about them, and ultimately we're destroying ourselves from the inside out because these policies have been so inverted to work against us, So I really love that you're seeing people sick of that and saying, what are we doing? Let's all unite together in our own communities and as a nation and throw out these different divisive tactics. We're better together. And that really says a lot about your work and the way that you've presented it that way.
Right, and that's the power of this book, and the folks in America and England both said the same thing about this, even though they hadn't been in communication, they're all just observing this, that the power of this, it combines all three: personal, political, spiritual. And I go into detail of what that looks like. And not just me, this was actually co-written with five other people. People in our Republic movement and also from other countries, like Tom House, he's a traditional Ojibwe elder who I've known for many years, who sits on the National Council of the Republic in Kannada. And so when you said politics, in here we explain that the word comes from the Greek word polis, polis. And all that meant in the Greek language was the city, because they were referring to Athens, which was the first place in the world that people practiced participatory democracy, not representative. where you sign your authority away to one guy and he does whatever he wants, and you only have a say, at the next election. Somebody did a funny cartoon. It shows a guy in a holding up a piece of paper, and there's 10 X's on it. And he says, "Here's your lifetime ration of democracy, right? 10 crosses every time you vote." And Jean-Jacques Rousseau in The Social Contract in the 1700s, he wrote that. He said, "In the English system of representative democracy, you only have a moment of freedom when you choose somebody, but then you lose freedom again because they are representing you, right?" That's not the Athenian model. 500 years before Christ, they had a model in ancient Athens, which was better than what we've got now. And first of all, every citizen was expected to participate. So they had big assemblies. And now, of course, citizen meant the non-slaves, and women, of course, weren't included. Okay, so there's that. But in terms of their world, all of the males had the right and duty, not just the right, but the obligation to attend these big assemblies where they would pass laws, and they would all take turns in being the archon, which was like the lawmaker, and to enforce the laws and to sit in the courts and everything. So you draw lots and say, okay, Emma's the judge this month. Okay, now you've got to take that responsibility. That way it's always shared, it's equalized, right? The responsibility and the power. Not only that, but we get the word ostracize, okay, from this Greek word ostracon. And that was a little piece of pottery. And whenever they didn't like somebody who was in power, they'd write his name on the ostracon and vote him out. He'd be ostracized. He would be removed from office. He was accountable at all times. So it was kind of like a contract. You have a contract with somebody, you say, okay, I'll do this if you do this. But if either side violates the contract, boom, you can walk. It's null and void right away. That's the way government should be. If people have voted somebody to, we don't use the word representative in the Republic of Canada. We say delegate because they're delegated to do a job by the people. If they don't do the job, the people go, you're out, because the power resides, like any American who reads their constitutions knows, the power resides in the people. There isn't a government separate from the will of the people. People combine and create a government, and they can remove it at any time. That's the simple idea that we're reviving in people, that memory, right? And so we go into the detail first about the political, and there's the personal, the spiritual is other aspects we can talk about as well.
Absolutely. I wanted you to, I would love for people to purchase this book. One thing I really love about your books, and I mentioned this to you before we came on, you don't write books leading people to different cliffhangers of keep buying, depend on me to give you, to lead you to where you need to be. You write the literal blueprints of how somebody can empower themselves 100% and not need anybody to do so in your books. And I think this one is a really great example of about that. And I wanted you to just maybe share anything else that you wanted people to know about it, because I think this is a really important one, especially because you do cover the personal, political, and spiritual aspects of our sovereignty. And this is on Amazon for people listening. You can get it from Kevin's website too. It'll take you right to the Amazon page. I'll link both, and we'll have a couple other book recommendations too on these topics for you guys.
Right. So we start in the book with the political because that kind of affects everybody. But part two is spiritual sovereignty. And the example I use to best understand this, because everyone, it's kind of a funny term. I make a distinction in the book between religion and spirituality. And I say, well, religion is kind of like comparing religion and spirituality is if spirit, which is from the Greek word pneuma, breath, right? It's inherent in all of us. But religion is kind of like the weather report describing the wind, right? It's describing something all the time. And it comes from a word in Latin meaning to tie people together, religion. So it's this kind of a natural bringing everyone together in one kind of group. I mean, that's like how empires operate, right? But spirit is inherent within all of us, like our rights, like, the common law, all of that. And by analogy in America, the way it happened was, remember I mentioned the folks who came over from England as kind of refugees when the monarchy was reestablished. They were instrumental the first principle was in our, because we were seeking their independence as a spiritual communities, right? The Puritans and others, they didn't want a king or a pope. They believed in Christ as the head of the church. And to practice that, they set up their own self-governing congregations where they would elect their own minister, right? And like Baptists today in America, they do the same thing. You can, you see this all the time. You don't need a theological education. There's no church hierarchy. Every congregation, every community governs themselves and they elect their own minister, right? That was the model among the Puritans in the 1600s when they're up there in New England. Well, naturally, the political system evolved out of that because in their town meetings and everything, they said, well, we govern ourselves spiritually. Why wouldn't we politically as well? So when you have that sense that we're all endowed by the Creator with the same nature, right? We're all part of that oneness. Why would we have a hierarchy? We don't have a hierarchy spiritually. Why would we have one politically and invest all power in a few people, like who can, pass laws without our permission, write executive orders, and everybody has to go along with it? That's got nothing to do with true self-governance and what America is all about. So it evolved naturally from the spiritual sovereignty into the political. And the personal is a harder one in a way to deal with. We'll get into that, but let me just, if you have any comments or questions about any of that.
Yeah, I would love to get more into it. And before we do, I wanted to bring up a couple other book recommendations that we were going to share real quick,
Okay.
just on these topics. Because again, I think your work is really important, and it's so affordable. It's right here on Amazon. People can get it in just a couple days. And so I would love to just help set up people for that freedom and sovereignty, and to learn more about it. So I thought maybe if you wanted to just talk a little bit about the case for Kanata, and then also the whistleblower's manual real quick, and then we can dig deeper
Go
into
back
topics.
into personal. We'll go back to the personal sovereignty because that's a really important
Yeah.
one. Okay, yeah, case for Kanata. Well, this was in 2015 in January. We had a convention in Winnipeg, over 200 delegates, about a third of them Indigenous people, and we established the framework, like what they're doing right now in England. They're creating a constitution, which really embodies the vision of what the republic should be, and we adopted. Originally, we had a flag with an eagle on a tree, and then the native people said, well, what about the Tuura Wampum? Now, the Tuura Wampum was the first original treaty between the Eastern Woodland natives and the Europeans when they came over. And the Europeans needed the natives in the East, both in America and Canada, because they were important in the fur trade. They were military allies when the French and the English were fighting each other. And so it was expedient for the Europeans to sign this treaty. And but what it said is that these two represent the blue lines represent the Europeans and the indigenous going down the river together, one in their own ship, one in their own canoe. And that was the notion that we will share the land together. It won't be one over another, right? Now, the Europeans went against that. They broke that covenant with the natives, of course. Like in America, they said natives are just like they still say they're like dependencies on the government. There's only American law, and we don't recognize native sovereignty or anything like that. And in Canada, it's worse because they're all wards of the crown, which means they don't even have legal status. They're not citizens. So Europeans kind of abrogated that, but the traditional native people still hold to it and say, our vision is that we will share the land together. And that's what the Republic of Canada is. It's the model for it is it's a federation of different sovereign nations within the one umbrella of Canada. And the three stars represent the English, the French, and the indigenous founding nations. So in the book, we lay out how we put that vision into practice with the assemblies, also training people. And that's why, I'm so glad about the show today because we can use it as a practical kind of training school, like this. A visual manual of what we're talking about with people who've gone from the 90% of people who are still watching and kind of not sure to the minority who are taking the next step to organize and put this into practice. And what we're saying here all the time is you have to understand your own history as a people, not what you get taught in school, but the living history. And we've described that. Like we go into detail about, like, there was an attempted rebellion in Canada against the crown in 1837, and it got defeated. It's one of the reasons the crown and the church has had such power here. But all of that is, again, based on a fraudulent power called the crown. We can revoke and step out of it at any point. And we give people a kind of how-to process of just like we do in the common law training manual about how to set up a common law court. We showed you how on the ground you can do this. And we've had some really great times, some fun times. Like, for example, when we formed the assembly in Vancouver, we went out and did a flag raising. We had a bagpiper. It was so stirring. It was the Scottish in me coming out, right? It just brought tears to my eyes. This bagpiper was playing. There was a whole group of us there, and we brought down the Canadian flag and raised the Republic of Canada flag, right? And then there was about two dozen people there who were newcomers. They all in unison took the oath of allegiance to the Republic. So they revoked their allegiance to Queen Elizabeth and her descendants and the Canadian government and laws, and we took it to the Republic, and they signed the citizenship cards. And at that point, they operated within their own jurisdiction. And that is so powerful when people do that together, because then they say, okay, we have an obligation to protect each other now, to work with each other. It's kind of a glue that brings people together rather than just another idea floating around the internet that never, like I say, it's ideas by themselves are like steam. Okay, it dissipates all over. But when you're doing the Republic and the common law courts, you need a piston to move the steam. So rather the steam moves the piston. That's you bring together the vision, the spirit with the practical organization, and then you get movement. But you can't have it with steam or a piston on them by themselves. Don't do it. You need their combination. And that's how we view this work. You know, the ideas are the first step in the discussion, but it's got to lead to these practical operations. You know, so we're thinking, I say to people, don't think theoretically anymore, think operationally, right? And think of how you're going to put it into operation in your own neighborhood.
Absolutely. And then we have gone over this one in depth on another episode. But this is one of my favorite books just because it really fits the theme overall of this podcast and people listening. But I think it also definitely complements the topic today, which is your whistleblower manual.
Yeah, well, I mean, I had fun writing it because I was just drawing on my own experience and writing it in a very kind of basic way for people. So that, honestly, okay, we're dealing with big institutions, and that's to our advantage because they have a set way they can operate. But we can maneuver. We have the freedom to outmaneuver them. And here's how you do it. And I kind of lead it through. First thing you're going to do, if you're ever targeted for anything, and you hold some evidence or some important information that they don't want coming out, the first thing they're going to do to you is it's all about silencing you. So they don't want to get too heavy because that draws more attention to you. So they seduce you by saying, oh, we can work this out. Just don't go to the press. We can work this out. Now, most people want to do that. They don't want to have a confrontation. If they think they can, you know, work it out with any hassle, they will. What, and that's what happened to me. They said, okay, let's negotiate. And they fired me without cause because I highlighted these disappeared children and the land deals and everything going on, the land theft by the church and big money and the government. They said we went into negotiation, but all that did was stretched out over 4 months. At the end, they canceled the negotiations. It was just designed to tie me up so that I couldn't go public with stuff. And that gave them the time to destroy evidence, silence witnesses, arrange their own narrative so that when I did go public, they could say, oh yeah, well we know about, you know, Kevin Anand, he's got a bad history, blah, blah, blah. They had all their PR guys in place. They needed time to do that. So what I say to people in here is that whenever you're holding important evidence and you're willing to go public with it, just do it. Don't wait for anybody else. Don't rely on your adversary to do the right thing because they never will. They have two priorities in a corporation, whether it's church, government, business, anybody. Efficiency and growth, right? They have to hold on, and these are machine priorities, not human priorities, right? And they have to sustain themselves. And people, you know, inconvenient whistleblowers or whoever get in the way of that. So they have a whole protocol that we've learned about how they deal with people like us. And so we go into all the lessons of that. And of course, Sun Tzu and the Art of War. I say to people, if you really want an education, go to the back of this book and read the 50 points the excerpts from Sun Tzu. And you'll learn a lot right there, because something as basic as never operate on the terrain of your enemy or you've lost the battle. And that's what everybody does. When you get upset, what do? You have a protest. Well, they're ready for protests. They want protests, because you're no matter how angry or determined people are, you're still asking for something from somebody in authority. And all they have to do is ignore you, and there goes your power. But if you don't worry about asking, like we did eventually after many mistakes and years of struggle on this, we said, okay, we'll set up our common law courts and put you guys on trial. Now you have to answer this. And look at the disproportionate effect. Two dozen of us force out the truth in Canada. We go on to force Ratzinger out of power because they don't know what to do when you're taking the initiative all the time. And, it's always basic strategy that you have to hold that initiative at all time and set the terrain of battle and do everything on your terms. And that's, in a way, kind of leads us to the whole issue of personal sovereignty, because that's difficult for people because we haven't learned that. We haven't learned how to govern ourselves yet. But this is one of the ways you learn, by learning. The best teacher is a black eye, right? I mean, you learn from it. And as long as you don't give up, and it's a tragedy when people give up, because then how do they apply all the brutality they've been through? How do you pass it on to the people if you're just going to crawl away and die somewhere? So we can't do that. We've got to share at all times what we've been through with each other, right?
100%, yes. And like I said, these books are all on Amazon. I would highly recommend purchasing them. And especially if you guys know other people who are sort of thought leaders like you. These make really great gifts or recommendations also, and they support Kevin so he can keep doing this work. So these are all on Amazon. The Truth Teller's Shield, the Whistleblower Manual. Like I said, that one can really apply to anybody and everybody watching this channel. I think that's something that's a theme throughout every single episode is that courage. And sometimes there's a lot to learn in the hardest things that we could ever go through. And these conversations demonstrate that. And hearing Kevin's personal experience is really inspiring for what he's learned as a whistleblower. And they're very positive things. And we also just did an episode with Juliet Ingle. That was really along those lines also on that personal sovereignty and whistleblowing and lessons learned and how to keep going. So I'm going to have that episode linked below. If you guys missed that one, definitely go back and watch it. It was a really beautiful episode. But Kevin, let's talk more about the personal aspect of this.
Right. So we're raised in a culture that's very atomized and individualized. So we talk about individual rights like they're an end in themselves rather than just part of a bigger collective. And the genius of the American Constitution was that they balanced both. Like I said, we have unalienable liberties. Nobody can take those from you. They're born in you, but they only exist when you practice them. But you don't practice them in isolation from everybody else, because I mean the best quote about that was right as the Civil War was starting in 1861, Abraham Lincoln. Let me read this. He said, "Many of our countrymen speak of liberty, and we are much in want of a proper definition of the word. Some men see liberty as a right to do what they will with themselves, while others see it as a right to do what they will with other men," referring to slavery, right? "Here we have two different and mutually exclusive understandings of the same word, yet each side calling it the same thing, liberty," right? So when people say freedom, what are they talking about? Is it like my freedom to do whatever I want? No, in the French Constitution, in the French Revolution, they said in 1792, they said, "Freedom is the right to do anything that doesn't harm another." Okay, so that's a simple thing. Your right doesn't then, boom, cross over somebody else's right, and then it's not a right, it's a privilege. And I experienced that when we formed the first assemblies, because in some of these communities, the people were fairly well off. I remember we had on Vancouver Island in a place called Parksville, we had a meeting in this guy's, it was a mansion. It was like a really big house. And a lot of these other people were either retired or they had professions, they had good careers, but they were upset about the COVID restrictions, right? And they didn't want to have the COVID restrictions. And I said, "Well, actually, these restrictions have been on a lot of people." And they said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Oh, well, Native people under the Indian Act, you can't refuse medical treatment. Like since 1874, it's been like that in Canada." they had to have special passes to leave the reservation or they'd go to jail. And they still operate under that. And they're all sitting there, well, but what does that have to do with COVID? And I said, well, why do you think they can get away with COVID? Because they were trying it out on all these other groups. So we've got to see beyond our living room here. And they didn't like that. Some people thought it was cool, but most people were threatened by that. And frankly, that assembly fell apart quick because they were just thinking of themselves. And they wanted a whole, and I said, well, if a right is just for you, it's a privilege. And you're trying to hold onto a privilege. But a right only exists when it's for everybody. Okay. Everybody, including the ones they're calling, illegal immigrants and all that. We're all human beings. We all have the right, a country based on immigration, the country that grew up because, the Statue of Liberty there saying, you're welcome because we want the model of the Republic to be shared with everyone all over the world, So that idea of individual versus collective, in the American Constitution, the idea was that you only get individual liberty secured when the whole republic is intact. Like John Adams said, unless we have a virtuous citizenry, you can't have a republic. A virtuous people are always thinking of their neighbor. They're not just thinking of themselves. They want to take care of the neighbor. And I was raised that way in my family in Winnipeg because we were descended from this kind of extended Scottish clan. And in the Scottish clan system, like with the indigenous, everybody takes care of everybody else. You don't, I was raised to think and to practice, you don't worry about yourself. You worry about each other, and then you hold each other up. The individual is sacrosanct, but only as part of the nation, right? And so that's how they come together, the personal, but people raised in a very individualistic culture. Me, 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 me first, and they equate that with liberty. It doesn't work because you're always fighting somebody else, and guess who profits from that? When everyone's fighting everybody else, you get a few elites coming in, and they say, "Well, then trust me," right? And it was interesting. Another really good guy to read is his name is Alexis de Tocqueville, and he was a French nobleman, aristocrat who came to America in the 1830s. He wrote a book called Democracy in America. And as an outsider, it's brilliant because he sees things that Americans don't. And he said, America will be prone to dictatorship because everyone and every farmer, and he went around the country and look, because most people are living on the land and they had their own farm and everything. Very few of them were city dwellers. And he said, everyone is so concerned about their individual liberty, which is unique. You don't see that in Europe, the idea of individual rights, but everyone is so concerned about their own life that the job of politics and governance will be then handed over to a few people, and that will lead to tyranny. So America has that black and white kind of two aspects, two-headed aspects to them. Everyone's talking about liberty, but in fact, look at, the Electoral College system, the Supreme Court are all political appointees. A few people in charge get the right to say, well, we don't agree with the election results. Us electors have put this guy in instead of the one who got most votes, right? I mean, that was all designed to keep power in the hands of a few while talking about liberty for all. So we've got to get from kind of that's why the thing in America is so exciting, this new development, because we're getting back to the original notion that the I is part of we and they're not separate at all. And so anyway, that's a new idea for some people, but it's really at the heart of what liberty really is about if it's meant for everybody, right?
Right. Now, sort of piggybacking off of the Declaration of Independence here in America, what does it usually take to overturn something like that to where it can be instituted on a national level or a local level as the new law, the new declaration? How does that work? Like, do you know like a percentage of the population that has to get on board with that or what it takes to overturn something like that?
Well, it's funny because states have different precedents for that. And like in America, it's, their state governments are almost autonomous. I mean, like you look at a state like Vermont and its laws and then compare it to South Carolina, and it's like, whoa, different countries, right? But they have a tradition. I know, I'll give you an example. In Pennsylvania, and I worked with a group there who enacted this. It was beautiful to watch. In Pennsylvania, it says people have the right to devolve power back to their community. And it's called having a home rule charter. And you don't need a percentage of the people, you just need Americans in a community to write up this charter, and you can pass your own laws, which are more valid than the state law. And the example the case in point was about 10 years ago now, in Pennsylvania, in a county in central Pennsylvania, Adams County, I believe. The Pennsylvania General Energy was going to take frack water. Now, fracking, it's polluted water, right? And they were going to dump it on the land. And about 700 people lived there. And this woman and her daughter, they're amazing people. They got together and they started going around door to door and saying to everybody, Republican and Democrat, and people who never voted, they said, look, we got to unite here and stop this. So they had an assembly, they passed the Home Rule Charter, and their first law was they abolished all dumping of wastewater fracking on their land. They had a long legal battle for it, and eventually they won. It took them a long time, but they just stuck to their guns, and they just cited the Pennsylvania State Constitution. So this is the beauty of America. It's already there. Like in Canada and England, well, Canada especially, we've never had self-governance. We've never had it. So we do have to challenge the system head on. In America, you just have to take it back. You just have to reclaim it. What's already there? It's already there in the hearts and minds of people. And it's also there in your own laws. But a lot of those laws are being nullified now with this corporate system we've got. Like I've told you the examples of these guys in Texas who set up a common law group and they all got targeted, and some of them are doing like 100 years in jail, right? For not appearing in court. It's just my friend in Chicago, he went into the Catholic Church and handed the priest a copy of my book and said, are you aware of this policy of crimin where Catholic priests have to, and any Catholic has to cover up child abuse? The priest calls the police. The police come and arrest my friend for talking to a priest. And they hand him a ticket and said, you have to appear in court. He walks into a room. It's not a court. It's a camera staring at him. And the voice out of the camera says, how do you plead? And he said, for what? You're not a court. You're a camera. He said, you have to plead or you'll go to jail. He said, this is not due process. It's not a court. And he pled not guilty, and they put him in jail anyway. Like, does that sound like the law to you? Does that sound like due process? That's what goes on all the time. And especially with the fervor now over immigration, and the ICE has a bigger budget than any other federal agency now. It's huge. And it's all about stripping people of their inherent liberties and locking them away for the private prison industry, right? And the for-profit prisons, if you look at a map of them, like a big company like GEO, which is one of the biggest for-profit prisons all over the South, all over Texas and the southern states. And they make money by getting judges on their payroll to criminalize misdemeanors, like failure to appear in court, 20 years, bang, because you're making lots of money for GEO that way. And the attorney general in Washington, Pam Bondi, is a former lobbyist for the private prisons till 2019. And she's the attorney general helping them by saying, okay, hit people hard with sentences so that we can profit. And that's so, in a way, in theory, it's all there in America, what we need. But at the same time, there's this other entity that's come in, which has almost turned everything the clock right back. So, in a practical sense, Americans do have to have another revolution, literally. And the more people you have in it, the less violent it is, right? You get go to the police and you say, stop. Stop serving this corporate power and get back to what, the republic's supposed to be. But that can only happen if you've got something to present to them as an alternative. And that's why, like one of the guys, John Bradley, who's chairing one of these they call them constitutional conventions. They set up a constitutional assembly that reestablishes the republic in their community, and they say, this is the republic now, because you can't find in Washington, you can't find in the courts. And they in the FBI and RCMP training manual says now, and I've seen a copy of this, anyone who uses the word sovereignty is a potential domestic terrorist.
What?
Well, that would include Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, all the founding fathers are now domestic terrorists. So they've hyped up the police to think, oh, you talk sovereignty, you talk the Bill of Rights, and you're a terrorist. It's like it's this counter-revolution that's happened. And we have to get back who we are, and that's kind of the reality of what we're in right now, right?
Absolutely, yes. And so, in working with people to establish sovereignty in all these different levels, and especially, for example, these groups that you're currently working with, I'd like for you to talk a little bit of maybe about some obstacles, some roadblocks, some things to expect along the way, and sort of how you help groups and how you've done yourself, how you've navigated those different things. Because obviously, this all sounds so great, and we need to empower people to go through that and to be able to get through it whenever there's those different things that might try to deter them.
It's not easy. It's you got to be honest with people right up front. Say, we're not promising you anything. There's no quick fix for this because it's taken years and years for this thing to come into place, this corporate dictatorship we're in, right? And so it's a lifelong commitment. And it's something you have to teach your children because they're going to be involved in this. It's not going to happen overnight, but there's ways that we've learned that you can act now to increase the odds on more in our favor. First of all, you don't go public right away, and you don't invite all these people into an assembly because it falls apart quickly because there's no common ground. There's different levels of understanding and commitment, and it becomes crazy that people are. It's like trying to herd cats. You're just there's no common ground. So what you do is you find a few people who are aware, who've known each other, because you can't do this work without trust and knowing each other, and you form a little cell group of three or four people. And you start doing things in small ways, and probing and finding a local sympathetic police and doing the education process. And eventually you get you each of let's say you have a cell of three people. Each one of those three goes out and recruits three other people. And you go through a training education process, and then after a while, there's 12 of you. And so you can then sign a charter and form a local republic assembly. That way you know each other. And if the boot comes down, you split off into the cell groups again, right? And it's more secure. It's like what you do in a police state. You have, and when you read tales from like resistance movements, like the French Resistance, and I've talked to people who were in it during World War II when I was younger, and they all operated that way. They had to have the cell groups because they couldn't be infiltrated as easily. You know, if you have a big organization, it'll get taken out. And I've been through that a lot. I know like all the signs. So start small, but realize that in your smallness is your strength, and you can keep control over it, right? It isn't some organization run by experts, you know. And you see that a lot on the internet. Like, I'm the expert. Follow this blueprint, and you'll be free. But they're just talking to individuals. They don't have a sense of, okay, but how do we does that work for the whole community, right? So that's kind of like basic common sense, but. The thing that's lacking is the determination, the will to carry on all the time. And it's exciting when your life finds that purpose. You know, the kind of the personal things we deal with in a day, they suddenly lose their importance. My dad had a story from the Korean War where he said there was this medic in their unit and they were under fire, and he would always be running around tending people, and people were saying, you know, look at this guy. He's right out there on the front lines. He has no fear. And he got hit by shrapnel, boom, boom, boom. And he's running around bleeding from the shrapnel. And somebody says, do you need help? He says, I don't have time for shrapnel. I'm too busy here. Right. And I always remember that quote, like, I don't have time for this. Like, okay, so I'm hit with shrapnel. It doesn't matter. These guys are dying over here. Okay. And that's what the difference between commitment and just being an observer, right? Because when you learn under fire is the only way to learn that what happens to you, yeah, it matters, but it's not as important as if you're just sitting there in a room by yourself where you become so totally self-obsessed, and the culture feeds into that, right? You know, all the time. They try to get you just kept in your little mental bubble and not connect with other people. So once you get out there and start doing things, and I say to people, it doesn't even matter what you do, just do something. Like Napoleon said when he was asked, how do you plan a battle? He said, I never plan a battle. I start something and I see what happens. Because a battle of any kind is like life. It shifts all the time. It's constantly in motion and shifts. And all your blueprints go out the window. You've got to always be observant on the ground, what's going on, and adapt and think in new strategies and tactics, thinking creatively like that, right? So it's a very exciting process because you have a sense after a while of waking up for the first time, right? People under fire say, I never felt more alive than when we're getting shot at, because life achieves, like finally see the meaning of it. Every moment of life is so precious. You've got to use every moment. And as opposed to kind of this 9 to 5 dead existence, we're raised to think that is life and it isn't, right? So,
Yeah, that story really touches my heart. It's a
yeah.
really relatable way of sort of explaining how myself and I think everybody that, every whistleblower, every survivor going forward, that's like a big question I'm sure you get. And something that's come up on the show sometimes is, pursuing action despite the obstacles that come in your path. And I think that really does come from elevating your purpose to something bigger than you. Of course we have a part in it and we have to take care of ourselves through it to make sure that we can sustain the endurance and the marathon. Like you said, change just doesn't happen right overnight because we get passionate about something. But I think it helps also really sort of deflect those bullets that come towards us too, because it's like how we see in your story, you've been defamed, you've had everything taken from you, you've had smear campaigns. I mean, the whole gambit has been thrown at you, $250,000 smear campaigns against one man, and so I'm sure you get asked all the time, how did you keep going or why did you keep going? And I think when we understand the consequence of not going forward, the cost of human life in the case of what we're talking about, genocide. When you think about that's still happening. This isn't just the past that you're talking about, even though you reference the past because that was where your journey started, but this is still going on today. And so the cost of not moving forward is this continuing and it's still just being covered up. And so I feel like when we know something and when we know change needs to take place, there's an honor in carrying that because we get to carry that for the people that didn't make it out of those situations and that are still in it, that wish that they could be in our shoes. I try to think about these kids in these schools that you advocate for and, all the different types of survivors that you advocate for of all different, abuse types, but how any of those children would just give anything to be able to have a voice, especially as they grow into an adult if they survive these systems. So it really is like it becomes an honor to get to fight, and the bullets don't you almost sort of repel them naturally because it's like, go ahead and attack me. Like, it's not about me. I'm doing this for other people. So go ahead and attack me all you want, but I need to go, into this burning building and get these people out. You can shoot at me all you want, but there's people being hurt right now that I need to attend to.
Well, that thing about the burning building is really important. I'm glad you raised it because there's a if you see a child in a burning building, you don't worry about the flames. There's this natural thing, and you don't have to be the child's mother either. Anyone, well, boom, go in there. And what is that? I mean, it's so inherent in us, right? And that's why I say to people, for your own, kind of well-being, you can never do anything by yourself because they love that. Then they go, oh, good, we're going to make an example of this person. Bang, throw him away for 20 years. When people tell the horror stories, I always say, yeah, but the person in a way brought it on themselves because they tried to do it on their own. You never just declare, I'm not paying taxes to Uncle Sam anymore. No, you form an assembly and pass a law and say, we're keeping federal tax in our community. And 50 people do that, that's harder to target 50 than one. So we got to start thinking together, not just how to do it, but doing it together at all times. You never, like another tip, you never go in if you want to challenge somebody, or you go into a court or whatever, you never go by yourself. You always have two or three witnesses and somebody with a camera. So you have a record of everything. And so just learning to operate that way is a new way of thinking for people, but it's essential. Otherwise, you don't last long and you get used. And, I mean, I've seen too many people who do that, who don't learn the lesson. And that's what these books are all about, passing on these truths, right?
Yes. And so speaking of court, obviously that is a big part of this is trying to get some type of law established in our communities that becomes an official law and overwrites whatever wasn't working. How do we enforce these court orders? Like, what's important to know about going to court? At what point would a group want to do that? And what do they need to prepare for that?
Well, we're talking about exactly that issue with this group in Texas that's been so targeted. And the first problem was they went into the existing courts. And what's set up now, they're not courts of law operating according to due process. They're more like military courts, administrative tribunals, where there's no due process. You're not assumed to be innocent. You're assumed to be guilty, and it's up to you. Like in a heresy trial in the Middle Ages, or what I went through, you have to go along and agree with the system and help destroy yourself. Otherwise, you get, you're somehow looking guilty for not doing that. So you don't go into the existing what are called courts at all. And if they try to come for you, there's ways you can defend yourself. It always involves other people. It declare, you know, it means going to the police locally and saying, that I don't recognize that jurisdiction of that court over me. And in fact, there's things like habeas corpus and mandamus writs that you can file in local court registry, and it says, I'm transferring, if you're being targeted, if there's a case against you, you say, okay, but I'm transferring the jurisdiction from this false court that has no authority over me into our own common law court, which we've established here, which does have jurisdiction because it's based on universal common law. And so we've helped people do that, but you need a team around you to do that. And that's why I say, don't ever try it on your own. Don't go into their jurisdiction. Contact us and we can help bring, that's what I do 90% of the time now with people, just bringing that support and knowledge to bear so that you don't walk in and put the noose around your own neck, which often happens. Enforcement, the power of enforcement in common law courts is tremendous because everyone is empowered to enforce the verdict, right? In a common law, and that's why Ratzinger, after we convicted him, he hid out in the Vatican till the day he died because he knew anyone can enforce that verdict against him to arrest the guy. So any citizen is obligated to be deputized by a sheriff, common law sheriff, and in effect made into a posse. Now that's got Western movies and that have made it seem like a posse is like a lynch mob. It isn't. It comes from a Latin term from the English shire communities in the Middle Ages, and every able-bodied man was expected to help defend the community. So if somebody was found guilty of murder, for example, everyone, the posse, were deputized local sheriffs who would then go and arrest the person to make sure they didn't harm anyone. Everyone has an obligation to do that. So, this verdict, I say to people, we're holding this gun in our hand. We don't even realize the power of what we've done. Every Catholic priest in the world is part of a criminal conspiracy to protect child rapists. That means you have the right to go and not just arrest them as individuals, but seize, their buildings and assets, and they have, and they know that. You see, they're not stupid. They know people have that power now, but they rely on people's fear and ignorance, to prevent that enforcement of that. But we could reclaim the whole world tomorrow if people knew that, because we own the world inherently, all of us, according to natural law, right? Especially when the people in power, so-called power, are convicted criminals.
Yes, exactly. And that's a hard realization, but it really is empowering to learn how our world works and then to realize that, hey, we've been letting all these people just rule over us. We've just been sitting back watching. It's time for us. Like, we can actually be the leaders of our world and take matters into our own hands. And so, kind of speaking of that, so you established the International Tribunal into Crimes of Church and State. You mentioned a couple of these other groups have established a group that has a name. What would you recommend if people do want to have a group? Is it important to have sort of an established organizational name? Do they need to incorporate? What's kind of a step to do that's the most effective in your opinion?
Well, not incorporate, because that's the system. That corpus means corpse, dead. You're becoming a dead thing. We don't do any of that. It's good to have a name and identity. We belong to this now, right? We don't belong to the old system. That's why citizenship cards, a flag, a name for ourselves, it's very important. That's absolutely part of this whole process, right? Thing to understand as well is that allegiances are something drilled into somebody's head from birth. And it's very hard to get people to switch an allegiance. So we don't, language is very important. We don't use the word allegiance. It's slave, master slave language, like please and thank you. These terms we're all trade, it's like subordinate. To plea in court, to make a plea. It's like you're pleading to the slave master, right? Like these are terms all designed to program you to Like the word arrogant, taught that's bad to be arrogant. The Italian word, it comes from arrogati, means to claim for yourself. Okay, so why is that a bad thing? It isn't, but your brain wants you to think when you're arrogant, you're being bad, right? And so you see the way we're all drilled to be functional slaves, even though they don't call it that, right? So when you start breaking out of that, you can't. It's too much of a mental shock to tell people we're ending this and beginning this. You say, no, we're reclaiming. We're reclaiming something that was always ours, but we've been kept in the dark. We've been kept asleep about all this stuff. Now awaken to this and just reclaim it. Because once you reclaim it, enough people do that, their whole system goes into the toilet. Because it's parasitic. It's a form of energy vampirism. It feeds off our attention. That's why I say to people, turn off the internet, folks. Those people don't matter. Look in the mirror, look at each other. That's how you get your power back.
Thank you for sharing that. That's really interesting. I actually didn't know that, even though I've thought about how strange it is that confidence is looked at. They don't, it's rarely heard that word arrogant and confidence sort of goes hand in hand, but it's always denoted as this negative thing, arrogance, arrogance, ego, arrogance. When I think when people don't have that, then like you said, they're very submissive and they give their power away to actual arrogant people in the definition that society thinks that it is. Somebody is going to have power over us if it's not us. If we don't take our own power back, then we're going to give it to somebody else to rule us, for us. And so I think that that's a really important distinction. And it's really actually interesting how we've sort of forgotten the roots of some of these words, even genocide, like how we talked about the
Oh,
first
yeah.
time that we chatted.
Well, it's funny. I actually start the book in the intro here with best examples are from our own family. And so when my daughter Eleanor was really little, she had two favorite expressions. She always said, "You're not the boss of me," to
Oh.
everybody. She would say that to everybody and to teachers in school. "You're not the boss of me," which is true. Nobody's her boss. She also said, "But why? Why, Daddy? Why? Why?" She was always asking why. So she had to know for herself because she knew that Eleanor was governing herself. She said, "I govern myself," right? Now, that's so common sense. And it's every child knows that. And that's why everything's designed to batter that out of them, that awareness, make them afraid of themselves, right? That way. But I always think that, yeah, the examples are so close to home. We just have to see it in our own family, our own life, right?
Yeah, we forget to that we have the power to ask why and that we deserve an answer if there's going to be a law or somebody trying to govern over us or tell us what to do. Instead of just accepting it, we'll complain about stuff without addressing that and saying, well, why? Can we learn the reasons and make sure that this is a good outcome at the end first before this is just thrown on us as being the law or a rule or something that we have to abide by?
Yeah, and kind of a PS on that story. Eleanor is now studying law
No way.
in America.
Oh, proud dad.
Oh, I'm very proud of her. She's like me. She's like me. It's like human rights law. Women in the law and that kind of thing. So
She's a
she's,
humanitarian like you.
well, she's, yeah, it carries on. I mean, and that's a metaphor for all of us. Like we are obligated to the next generation to pass this on, right? So
Absolutely.
on their shoulders.
And so, in this quest, going back to sort of the talking about getting people together, taking action, in your experience, what have been some of the big successes that you can share? And then also on the other end, what are some of the kind of pitfalls or failures that you've gone through that you've learned from and that we can learn from with you?
Well, there've been so many victories, and people expect huge immediate results from victory. I think it's part of the movie culture, when you see these things in television or movies. But
Definitely.
the victories are because it's all human, it's very, very personal and very up close. And when I saw people who couldn't even, like the example of William Coombs being in the church with us that day, when the sound of a church bell would terrify him, make him vomit. And there he is, it's like a new person. Just the power of that. And when everyone saw him like that, we were in tears. We were embracing each other when we walked out of the church because we knew we had turned the tide there. And sure enough, that same month, the government started talking about apologies and missing children directly because we were occupying those churches. And the look in the eyes of those people and the sense we had among each other, these are mostly poor Aboriginal people who've been under the boot their whole life, okay, and traumatized and tortured from a young age. The hope in their eyes, suddenly, we caused that. Okay, we caused that. That was a victory that went boom. It just had, it's still having a ripple effect, right?